here we go. Looking good. I'm so sorry to interrupt. I just want to tell you we are recording now.
Okay.
So you can start shuffling those cards if you like.
Okay.
And when you decide to answer one, just speak into the mic. Don't touch the mics and give me your name a couple of times and you're good to go.
Okay. You don't have to answer them.
Nope, don't touch them.
So just leave them.
Yep.
Let's start off by introducing ourselves.
He reminds me of my son.
Oh. That's so sweet.
Well, I talked to him. I think we were at somewhere else before.
It was here. So you met him here.
Okay. Pat, you want to start off with your introduction?
I am Pat Payne, director of the Indianapolis Public Schools Office of Racial Equity and Inclusion.
I am Cleet Land, Cleet like a football cleat, but spelled C-L-E-T-E. I'm an educator, historian. I'm with the University of Phoenix College of Education. And I'm also with the Indiana Council on Educating Students of Color.
I'm Elizabeth Mitchell. I'm a historian, documentarian, playwright, radio show host, everything all about African-American history, sharing, researching, and preserving.
I'm Jennifer Pace Robinson with the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, and I have been an educator, exhibit developer, experienced curator, and my particular focus has been on difficult truth and difficult history and elevating underheard voices.
Well, Jennifer, you aren't just with the Children's Museum. You are the CEO.
But I'm new in the job.
Yes,
I've been the president for 2 years now.
So thank you,
Dr. Payne.
Well, it's so nice to meet you. I met a gentleman that's, I think he's over the theater.
Aaron Bonds?
Yes.
Yes.
He is with the family that had settled in the creek.
Yes.
And I'm helping them with their cemetery and trying to clean it up. And most importantly, not to accept what they're being told, that that cemetery is not theirs.
Right.
It is theirs, period. But they're trying to say that the cemetery doesn't belong to anybody. And I go, well, their DNA is there, over 100 bodies. You can't say that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's the fight.
Aaron, yeah.
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 Yeah. So I met him, and that's
he's
great.
Terrific.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know Diana Daniels?
I certainly do. That's who called me to come on board. Diana Daniels, and she and I went up to the Roberts Settlement. On my own, I've been collecting dirt from all of the early black settlements. I've talked to the State Museum to get me an intern to help me collect the dirt for a permanent exhibit on all of the black settlements, because there were plenty of them. Ask me if anybody's taking a bite and helping. No. So that's another fight. There's so many fights on different battles and different levels. Where do you begin? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So did you want to pick a question and go from there, or you got something you want to say? We could do that. Okay. There you go.
I'd like to continue the conversation.
Discuss class and racial disparities you've experienced and are witnessing in your community. I'll start. When I went to high school, we had to take a test to get into short range. And you had to score a certain amount to get into short range. And I did. It was the same year that Father Hardin and Dr. Andrews and James Brown protested short range. They then protested short range because of racial disparities and inequities. And I've been involved with the father ever since then. And the other thing was that when I went to the military, I joined the Army to get out of Indianapolis. And I was, after completing my training at Fort Knox, Kentucky, they sent me to Fort Harrison, back to Indianapolis. And so while I was there, I was attending the Defense Information School, which is next to West Point, one of the most classiest facilities in education facilities for the Defense Department. And I was walking through the library, the military history library, and saw a section, Black Military History. This was in 1976, Black Military History, and found out about the 6888, the 13 Tuskegee Airmen from here, the Rockford Point Marines that were from here, Willa Beatrice Brown Chapel, who helped set up the curriculum for Tuskegee Airmen and trained over 300 Tuskegee Airmen. And so when I saw that, I said, well, why isn't this in the schools? Because it was in the schools, but why is it, how come it's not in the schools, but it's in the military library? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So that was my experience with racial disparity.
I don't only experience it, I see it every day, working with Black and brown children.
Even today in 2023, has things changed, Pat? Gotten any better?
No, they haven't changed. And in some ways, it's getting worse. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really crazy that you know who's going to be at the bottom before the test is even given. But that's the way it is. That's the way we have to help our teachers understand. This is not something that you just accept and say, well, that's the way it's always been. That's why every single person who touches the life of a child in our school district has to go through 2 days of racial equity training. 2 days, 9 to 5. And it's not just everybody on our staff. We have community partners who go through that same training because systemic racism is shaping the outcomes of wherever they are also. So it's, that's why I haven't retired. I can't even retire yet. And that's the reason, just dealing with this. I just can't allow myself to retire and sit back and watch TV. I mean, there's other things that I could be doing if I retired, but I want to be on the front line. Mm-hmm. I want to be right here where these children are. And then you got all this craziness that like Mind Trust and charter schools, that is a big problem. Because parents feel that they want to do whatever they can for the benefit of their children. So they think that that's for the benefit of their children. I have never been in favor of charter schools. I do not like that they are taking public money that should be going to traditional public schools to strengthen them. And there is still no evidence that they are doing any better than the traditional public school. I think that's just throwing a whole nother wrench when we should be concentrating on getting rid of these disparities and disproportionalities, but you got all this political mess still.
Has the school system done any better with hiring Black teachers? What is the ratio there?
It's still a problem. It's still a problem. We're trying to do better. I mean, 90% of our teachers were white.
And the population of Black kids?
Oh, it's about 55%. Black children, and almost 25% Latinx children. So their experiences are completely different from this children. So it's
the state released a report last week that they're short between 3,300 and 3,500 teachers.
Oh yeah.
And that like states like Florida and Texas are taking anybody with a high school diploma. And Indiana is looking at ways to recruit teachers. That's defective as well. That's defective as well.
Yeah.
Because nobody, number one, the pay. because I'll give you an example. My brother-in-law and I, we both took out student loans at the same time. He got a job in engineering. He graduated from Rose Hill and got a job in engineering. Went to work for Navistar. I went to IPS. His salary was $53,000 a year. Mine was
$22,000. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Student loan payments the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want to remind everybody, I'm looking at these tips. Please refrain from knocking on the table because this is going to pick everything up and interrupt what we're saying. So I talk with my hands, so I'm going to keep my hands off the table.
I'm rolling this piece of paper.
And do like this. Okay, sweetie. You
know. All right. Well, this is Jennifer. I would love to go back to what Cleet was saying. How do I do a better job of representing that history that isn't in schools? Because I know that it's so hard to change curriculum and to bring things into a classroom, but as an informal learning organization, we can tackle some of that. And so I think specifically about the Tuskegee Airmen, and I love being in this museum because you've got Walter Palmer and Art Carter, and those are two individuals who grew up and lived by the Children's Museum, and we've done exhibits with them and had them in the museum, and you can't deny that they're real people. And they have a history and they have a story. And so what I've seen is those instances where it's just so easy to kind of forget about big chunks of history and forget about people. I think about Oscar Robertson, and he didn't get to have the parade with their victory, you know? And so that's all in the past, but I think that idea that some people are, that some children are not as important as other children, really bothers me. And so we're trying really hard to, how do you have every child who comes in the door feel like their point of view matters, but also do more to get every child in the door. And so part of that is a funding solution. So not just funding the building of new exhibits, but funding, we're trying to get like a school field trip fund so that all of IPS can come for free and you don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. And what we can do to just open the doors and let people in, and then we'll partner with people to tell the history that needs to be told. So I've seen that and we want to fix it.
Well, I grew up here, born and raised here in Indianapolis, and I remember when the Children's Museum was free.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I have the story correct, because since I've been here talking to Leon and different people, some of the stories of what I've been told have been incorrect. So this may be an incorrect story. But there were so many black kids coming to the museum. The white people were afraid to come, and they implemented fees to come into those doors. And that mirrored what was happening with the zoo, where it was located. The blacks would come in, Joe Reed, park the car, shine the cars, and white people visiting the zoos were afraid, and they thought, we got to take that zoo out of Washington Park and move it, and the fees to go to the zoo here are exorbitant, where I can go right over to Illinois or anywhere near and go to a free zoo. Again, keeping certain elements out, and we perceive that was to keep us out. My money's green. You don't want it? So be it. I don't have a problem. I can drive to where it's free. It really bothers me, too, that the school system, like Pat said, has not changed from when I was a kid. Now, I was a kid during segregation. Mm-hmm. I lived through it until we integrated high schools. Being a kid, it was great. It was a wonderful experience. Mm-hmm. I got taught by the best teachers that cared mm-hmm. for me, mm-hmm. but the community cared for me. We lived in a community among ourselves, and unbeknownst to the white race, who got the wrong perception, we loved each other. We had good times. I remember going to the Indianapolis Recorder picnics.
Oh, yeah.
I went to that. My father was head of one of the community centers for Powell Club. That was a ball. We had a ball, not being around the white race. Now, I'm not saying go back to that. I'm just saying my experiences, because I wasn't an adult. I wasn't my mom and dad trying to get a job, which you wasn't going to get. I wasn't trying to take care of a bunch of kids, which we all had 6, 7, 8, 9 kids, the parents. So I didn't have to go through the hardships of being an adult. But that togetherness, us being together, I missed that. When I moved to Bloomington, it was segregated still, breaking up slowly but surely. This is the one thing that I witnessed. When they started hiring blacks in some of the, what do you call them, premium jobs. I don't know if it happened here, but they hired one black individual and you had to look like you was black. And we called ourselves the onesies. And that's because we come in all colors, from eggshell to eggplant. Blonde hair, blue eyes, dark hair. That's what we are as a race. And so if I was much lighter or had different color eyes, hazel, I wouldn't get that job, because they wanted people to walk right in that door and said, oh yeah, you got a black person. So some of the lighter complected people in Bloomington couldn't get a job. And that was with Reverend Butler fighting when he left Connersville, came to Bloomington in 1959, and no blacks were in. I can go get a job in somebody's kitchen. That was it. The men could go sweep the floor or be a porter. That was it. And Butler changed that under threat, death threats, his house being burned. This was in Bloomington. This wasn't in Mississippi or Alabama. And so he was smart enough to go to all of the white churches, which there's a bazillion of them on every corner in Bloomington. And he told all the ministers, this is your responsibility to change the climate here. And then so they started hiring the first onesies. And for a first year or two, if you were the first woman on the job, it would be the same. Hard.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, when you're the first,
You're
going to pay the piper.
Yeah. There hasn't been a woman in charge of the Children's Museum for the past 40 years.
Then you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So. You're going to run up, and some of them may keep it to themselves and do their little dirty work down here, but then you get it. Okay, that answers that.
Let me say this, though. Yeah. When you're talking about the Children's Museum and how they can be part of the education for black children, I do presentations on the importance of teaching local history to our children, because when I was 5 years old, I met Dr. Martin Luther King. Didn't realize who he was, okay? But nonetheless, when he came here to St. John's Church multiple times, you know, our church was 2 blocks away, Trevon was 2 blocks away, but we went. And then just to be able to say that, to say that when Malcolm X went to Detroit, my uncle, my brother, and myself went. You know, I was 6 years old. You know, my brother and my uncle, they were very radical, I guess. You know, but they instilled some things into me to learn more about our local history. And in 1968, Robert Kennedy was at the park, and announced Dr. King was assassinated. We were there. Our whole community was there. And the pictures that I have shows that 90% of people that were there were children. Okay. And so we tell that story. We share these stories. And as I grew up, I learned to listen, because Arthur Carter would say, "Come up here. Let me tell you something, little fella." You know, they would talk to us on the porch. We was like, we ain't trying to hear that. We ain't trying to hear that. Uh-huh. But then, fast forward 10 years from 10 years later, I'm reading about this brother in the book, in books, in his associates, in books at Fort Harrison. And so what we do is we go into the nursing home, and we had this queen right here. She shared her story with my students. So my students go in and they collect oral history, but they get directly from the historian. And then they have to transcribe it, so they're learning the writing
process.
That's
the way to the learning process. Well, you said St. John's, so we have a new exhibit about religion. And you need to come, because I know they called you, because we wanted to feature a local church. So we, in that exhibit, we talk about St. John's Baptist Church and Reverend Brown and
Andrew J. Brown.
Reverend Brown. Do I have, yeah, in the exhibit we do.
Okay.
Yeah, we have them in the exhibit.
Yeah, I have a picture of Brown, Abernethy, and King.
And they talked about King, seeing King. Mm-hmm. And that happened right here in Indianapolis. You know, in that church, you know, we're talking about all these famous places around the world when right in our back door.
Pastors were opposed to them bringing Dr. King here.
What?
The black pastors?
Troublemakers.
They fell for the okadote.
They
drunk the Kool-Aid.
That's down south, and Sister Margie saying up south.
Up south. Oh, yeah.
But also getting that word out, because, you know, the word that spreads is when we do the big popular exhibits, you know, the Minecraft exhibits and the popular exhibits. But how do we get that same momentum behind, like, this world religion exhibit?
Mm-hmm. This crisis right now.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
We also talk about Frederick Douglass, because Frederick Douglass came here at least six times.
Yeah.
And the V-Line Railroad, which is the railroad on Massachusetts and Sherman Drive, and then the airport.
Yeah.
The airport was where the drive-in became the drive-in.
Yeah.
That was the airport. But Mr. Settles, he said he shined Frederick Douglass' shoes at the railroad before he went out to Pendleton and got his arm broken.
Yeah. And I just went up to Pendleton to that marker and saw he was on a flatbed truck. Yeah. They drug him off that truck and beat him near to death.
Frederick Douglass?
Yeah. He came back 4 years later. But how I heard the story, the sheriff in Bloomington, well, he's not the sheriff now, the once sheriff, it was his family, Quakers, that saved and kept Frederick Douglass in their home.
Yeah.
And to heal him and got him a doctor until he could go back to, Massachusetts, New York, somewhere out east.
Mm.
Then he came back about 4 years later. But I did not know he had made 9 trips here.
I'm telling you, please.
Well, that's why the east side is named everything over here as the Frederick Douglass Park. Golf course, the Douglass Little League.
Mm-hmm.
And when we played Douglass Little League, we didn't know that it was Frederick
Douglass
Little League.
Uh-huh.
And so then we did a presentation on the history of the golf course and the segregation, and then we found out all this other information. And then Father Harden, who portrayed
Frederick Douglass, he did all this other
research and pulled out all this story and shared it with us. And it was just so amazing. But we don't really appreciate how important our local history is.
Yeah. Do you have pictures of St. John's? Is that what you're pulling up?
I've got a lot of pictures.
Now, the play that I'm putting on stage next weekend, I have a series called Remarkable Women, and we're talking about the women's suffrage and women's rights, everything, all women in the black community. And there were women's clubs that sprung up all over America. And Madam C.J. Walker was involved. I just finished a documentary about West Baden Color Church. There was a woman speaker there named Bessie Powell that was on par with Frances Harper and Alice Dunbar Nelson, the wife of Paul Lawrence Dunbar. She drove up here to participate in these women's clubs and went everywhere. And I'm thinking, how did they do all that? There wasn't cell phones, it wasn't the car.
How'd they know?
And they communicated and just participated, and these clubs were so successful. And they were
lift each other up.
Building women's self-sufficiency, self-mobility, getting an education, just empowering black women. That's one of our show next weekend in Bloomington.
People don't want to say we were there. If you look at
at this.
90% of the people there were children now.
And my husband was there.
My parents and my other parents said they wouldn't go because they were afraid they'd lose their jobs.
And my dad couldn't go, he was a policeman. Because they said,
So they allowed us to go.
You know, I got a job, my first job was at the police department, Pat.
Really?
Well, my dad said it was part of his graduation present. You show up down there Monday, you got a job. I had to get rid of my afro.
Of course.
And he said they're going to think you're militant. Mm-hmm. We're all working for whites.
What year was that?
1971. We got to please whites. We got to do what they say. You got to speak like they want us to speak. Everything was dictated by white men, because white women didn't mean nothing. White men dictated everything in this country. So I had to get rid of my afro. I had to go somewhere and get my hair pressed. And then you had to act a certain way. You couldn't be yourself because you could not intimidate a white man.
So what happened?
So I asked my dad then, I said, are they scared of everything?
And then, like, years later, how do you undo that? Like, how do you, like, you had to stuff down a part of yourself.
I had an incident that happened right there, and that did it. Right there in the middle of the floor, I'm the only black woman or black employee in records, and I was called the N-word, and I started crying. Now, here I thought I was cute. I had my mini skirt on and my makeup, and this white woman who was a sergeant, she was in charge of records. She said, Liz, you go to the bathroom and wash your face. When my makeup had ran, I looked like a raccoon. So when I went into the bathroom and saw myself in the mirror, I said, never again will I cry. Somebody's gonna cry, but it ain't gonna be me. That moment, I turned into the bee. In that moment, and I come out of that bathroom, like, say something to me now. I wash my face, and from then on, a force to be reckoned with. So those moments and what we were put through as a people made us strong. You either got stronger or you just laid down.
So Dr. Pat, we were talking about, you said it's getting worse. So kids today, where we thought we would be further, right, are still having these, and then we expect them to do well in school and, you know, do all these other life requirements when they're carrying an unseen burden.
But I don't depend on a lot of it, and Pat, I tell you, is my family, where I come from. And even with my grandkids, I teach them black history. I take them places. It's that strong family connection. Now, if you don't have that, I feel a responsibility to all kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So not mine, but others. So if you don't have somebody, like he said, he was sitting on Brown. If you don't have that in your community, it just ain't gonna happen. Mm-hmm. And so those fortunate ones, you know, probably Pat had a strong family background.
Right, that allows you to push through.
So my family, that man right there is my grandfather.
Where?
That photo. That's my granddad.
Oh my God.
He wanted to go to Purdue, but he couldn't go because he was black. So he went to Butler.
Is there another question?
Here, I think you pull it out of the deck.
Yeah, but get another card.
Okay, then we just had our blank conversation.
Okay, we just had our blank conversation.
Pull another card.
Oh. Discuss possibilities for defunding the police and unarmed mediation in our communities. Discuss the possibilities for that?
I'll take that question because I'm from a police family. The word defund bothers me. Who are you going to call when you in need? You going to call the Walmart greeter? I think that word in itself turned people off and turned me off. I'm not sure what word to come up with, transferring money. I do know there, since we released everybody or a lot of people from the mental health hospitals, a lot of our problems stem from that. So we need other people than calling the police because they're showed up with the training to shoot.
Now, I don't agree, and my husband don't agree. He's just retired from 35 years. My dad put in 35 years as a homicide detective here, shooting people in the back. No, for any reason. If you're afraid of that as an officer, go get another job. But other than that, they are trained to shoot to kill. You pull a knife out, you gone. You got a gun, you're gone. But some of these people have mental health issues. So we do need to transfer funds to go to a mental health issue. So when you call the police, they ask you, it all starts with that operator.
Mm-hmm.
What, and she needs
important
to ask
job.
More questions important to job. Send the right help to you. And then people need to understand the first thing. Why were police created in America? And we still had that mindset. That was to put black men down in their place. So that mindset, all these hundreds of years, and then that fear of a black male. Because they're treated differently than I am. I have my own issues, but it's not so much like everything is geared toward black men and the fear of what they think black men will do. So that's my take. Anyone else?
I had a lot of positive experiences with Power Club officers.
Yeah.
Because they were coaches and they helped build our community and our neighborhoods. You know, it's called Police Athletic League.
Mm-hmm.
So we played baseball, football, basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something every season where these were full-time police officers who did this after they got off. And so we had relationships with them, but they also lived in the neighborhood. Now, a lot of today, they don't live in our neighborhood. They're nine times out of 10, they're recruited from outside. For example, my father-in-law had a farm in Putnam County. And the state was going around buying the farms from people who was not successful as farming. And a lot of these were white people, rural white people. They sold their farms, they got jobs in the prisons, they built the prisons on top of the land. You know, they converted the land from farm to a prison industrial complex. And then they gave them, those people who were not successful at farming, they gave them the jobs. Then Tenenbaums talks about in 1865, there were less than 100 black men in Indiana in prison facilities. By 1875, there were over 2,000. Okay? So we talk about the prison industrial complex and law enforcement. A lot of the laws, when people would come across when they would escape and come across the Ohio River and think that they were free, people here would hold them for the slave catchers. And a lot of those people that would hold them were law enforcement, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at this, Indiana, the Circle Monument, people think that it is a monument to the wars, but it's a monument to the South. Because Indiana, although the political apparatus was free, the population was Confederate sympathizers.
Mm.
If you look at that chained up individual at the bottom of the at the thing,
I know what you're talking about.
You know,
yeah.
and then you read the artists, the descriptions and stuff like that. But if you search history and talk about what the artists were talking about, he was holding this guy for the slave catchers. Okay. The stories, they change over the years, but a lot of people, again, I'm from Brightwood, Martindale, from Martindale primarily, and we had people that were alive in the 1880s, my grandfather and my great-grandfather. My grandfather was born in 1886, okay? My mom was born in 1923, okay? And so he would tell us stories about Indiana, about Lick Creek, about Vincennes, about Seymour, about Greenwood, about a really strange thing happened is we took kids to Selma in 2022 to the Equal Justice Institute, and they have all these markers, these things where they have the names of everybody that was lynched. And James Good is Donnie Daniels' ancestor. Mm-hmm. And below that, three names below that, is Homer Epps. He's related to Mike Epps, the comedian. Then two names below that is Eli Ladd. And I was blown away because the student said, "Mr. Ladd, is he related to you?" I had never seen him. I've been there since like the 80s. I mean, not to there, but since about 19, we've been taking the trip for almost 40 years. But when they built this thing, I did not know that Eli Ladd was lynched in Henry County, which is right outside Greenfield, Indiana.
Yeah.
And so my cousin, Reverend Keith Ladd, works for the Smithsonian Institute. I sent the information to him. He found out that our great-grandfather and Eli Ladd's father were half brothers. Okay, so they had different slave mamas. So I've challenged my kin, my relatives, to do the research because my plate is
I know you. Mm-hmm.
But I've challenged my kin to do the research on it because Eli Ladd is on this memorial. His dirt is in the jar.
Oh.
And I've been there. As many times as I've been there, I had never
seen
him.
And that's your
relative.
Oh,
my gosh.
But the student said, "Mr. Ladd, is he related to you?" And Diane Daniels, she learned the same thing. She learned about her the same day, too. Because she said, "Wait a minute, I had some family members down there." And then she called somebody, and then they called somebody, and they called her back and said,
"That's him.
That's your great uncle." Jeez.
And it's not that long ago.
No.
So, and that's where I want to know, how can I help with this sense of urgency? Because you talk about, I grew up here and my grandfather was born in 1897. Okay. I didn't hear anything about the Klan, about segregation, about, you know, not until I grew into my own person and started becoming an educator. So this is a whole chunk of the population that has not been taught to care about what was going on in our own community, you know?
It's a lot of stuff back then wasn't talked about. You didn't talk about colorism. Well, you think of people from Africa as being this complexion. Well, how do we get like this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get like this? There were some white men involved with that. Mm-hmm. So African Americans are probably more European than African. And it was due to one, two, three, several white men making babies. And then when they stopped slaves from coming in, you know, they put a stop to that. We still need them. We got women out there.
How long does this go on?
Oh, 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's a whole new ball game,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, but it's a thing. Yeah. I mean, it's a...
So they start making babies, you know, and then they ain't going to talk about that. And I don't know how the white women was taken, but they...
Well,
that
I think
kind of
a lot of people just ignored things, you know, and not...
Well, even in individual families, Pat, you probably got grandparents that knew stuff. They weren't...
Oh,
I certainly did, and when
you
I mentioned talk. Something one day, they go...
That's right. You kept it quiet.
Yeah, you got to be quiet. And I still kind of had that mindset, you know, you don't tell all the family business.
Mm-hmm. My father had a stand on the city market, only black person down there.
Oh, wow.
And he wasn't the
fruit
first.
Vegetables.
Yeah, he was selling fruits and vegetables. And there's a long story to how he got the stand, because he worked his way through college working for Mr. Zears. Mr. Zears owned the stand. But when Mr. Zears, he was assaulted, really, by a group of people, and he handed it over to Dad. He wasn't the first, though. Francis Stout's family was the first. Anyway. The thing that always amazed me after I got older was, I know that as the only black man on that city market and all these different cultures were there growing stand, he had to have suffered so much racism, but we never heard a word about about it. I don't ever remember him talking, you know, about the experiences he had as the only black man on that city market.
He sucked it up and took it. He went to work every day.
He talked to my mother about it, but he didn't talk to his children about it.
From my grandfather's and great grandfather's standpoint, they were protecting us.
Protective. But was it really? But in their minds,
yes.
But what I mean, like, my family didn't talk about it to me.
Yes.
You know? And so.
What were they going to say?
I don't know. But it's kind of like everything was okay. Like, it's almost like it was like, oh, things were great. Or things. You know, and I just, if maybe, we're going to break the cycle, like, how do we?
Maybe they had that mindset unknowingly, but now they say it out loud. We don't want to hurt white kids' feelings. So it wasn't said out loud then.
Or give them a guilt complex.
Yeah, we don't want to do that. So what were they going to tell them? Because our experiences weren't great.
Yeah.
And so what are they going to say? We all mistreated them. We haven't.
Right. That. And that's like the realization
when
of what happened.
I went to high school.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was walking to.
Yeah.
My parents didn't say, look, this is what you need to watch out for.
Yeah.
This is what's going on. None of that. You went cold turkey into the storm. There just was no conversation.
Yeah.
So
I
you
wasn't
getting
it,
and I didn't get it either.
So what do we do now? You know, that's
we're going to have to figure it out. Because
yeah, that's what we're doing. We're figuring it out.
I don't have all the answers.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we have to figure out collectively. Because to act black people to come with all the answers, we're still not in charge.
Yeah.
We ain't running things.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any difference what we say.
We
never have. And there is a huge fear of us getting it.
Yeah.
And I hope I'm alive when we do. I have interviewed 10 white men from 70 to 80 years old. I had one question for all of them. What are you afraid of? 3 out of 10, I feel, answered me truthfully. We're afraid you're going to treat us like we've treated you. We are afraid you're going to take our stuff. And number 3, you're going to be in power. We're used to having it. And to relinquish that power, we ain't looking forward to it. That's why brown-skinned people have a difficult time coming in here. People love Trump because he said it. We want people from Norway. We don't want people from the mother country.
He sure did say.
He said it, so they love him. Them poor people send him money to get him out of jail. Poor people. He don't care nothing about them, but he's saying what they can't say. And that's putting them fear in a lot of these people. Yeah, because if they get in charge, you're going to be in trouble. You ain't going to get no job. You ain't going, because they're going to take care of their own. They don't know the spirit. And that's
the
living
spirit,
with us in this country, but not knowing us.
Yeah. I've got to get to back to Martin University.
Okay.
It is so good to meet you. Let's
so
be in contact.
Good to see you.
I'm going to call you. I don't know when to be on my radio show. I'm going to leave the country for a month. When I leave U.S.,
where
I'm gone
going?
A month. Singapore, Maldives, Malaysia, 7 black queens, no husband. No husbands, honey. We're leaving them.
That's
we're leaving
lovely.
Them here.
That's lovely.
Oh, so nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you.
I'm staying. I guess I don't know where
I'm staying. I'm going to stand up.
I'm staying
nice
up.
To meet you, sir. I'm blessed. You bless me.
Are you going to say goodbye to your son?
I'm going to show him a picture.
Oh, are y'all all done? Y'all all done?
Yeah, I got to go.
Okay.
Oh, we're going to start back up.
Oh,
we're just
are.
Taking a break. Someone does have to leave.
Okay.
They said 10 more minutes, so then we take a break and start back up.
Oh, no. At the 10 minutes, we're finished with the session.
Okay.
Oh, well, honey, we knocked it out the ballpark. This is great.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining this conversation.
I wish I had never heard of these talks before.
Oh, yeah. I'm
I
so glad
I host one in Bloomington.
Absolutely. Just reach out to
us. So who do I contact about hosting one?
You can, I don't have any cards, but you can.
You didn't bring any cards,
I'm new. They haven't printed me any cards yet.
Because I think the
this is important.
Okay, if you have your card, then I'll take it.
I got my card.
Okay.
Halfway we'll try.
Okay.
Okay.
Let me just end the recording. This is Keandra Vils Freeman. The date is October 21st, 2023. This is Table 1 of People's Table at Crispus Attucks Museum.
One thing I was wanting to do is to have a panel of whites saying, what are you going to